Welcome to the podcast of this Brecan information session. Information sessions are recorded at the Brecan Resource Centre and can be borrowed in CD format from the Resource Library. Sessions are copyrighted and are for personal home use only. If you would like to know more about this and other sessions, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500. We hope you enjoy this podcast.
Welcome to Volume 73 in the Brecan What's On Information Sessions, a series of talks produced for people with gynecological or breast cancer, their families and friends. This session was recorded on the 17th of October 2011 at the Brecan Resource Centre in the Queen Victoria Women's Centre, located in Melbourne's CBD. Natural does not automatically make something safe. Naturopathy is a widely used complementary approach to dealing with fatigue, depression, anxiety and stress. In this session, Anne-Marie Bortoli and Sophie Mikosa, naturopaths and herbalists from Melbourne Holistic Health, will talk about these issues as well as the symptoms of menopause and discuss the new evidence on the role and safety of phytoestrogens. We hope you enjoy this session.
Thanks for having us here today. My name's Sophie and this is Anne-Marie, and we are naturopaths at Melbourne Holistic Health. And today we're going to go through a look at some naturopathic approaches to medically induced menopause. And there's a couple of things I wanted to say. One of them is that as naturopaths and working in the holistic health group, we certainly don't see ourselves as being alternative to the medical profession. We work in a very complementary way. The other thing is that this is a talk that has been, we've added a lot of research to, but it has been a talk that Sandra Villela, who's another naturopath, has given here before. And so you may have remember her, and she gave the talk for a few years. So the things that we're going to be going over is looking at the difference between natural and medically induced menopause, looking at some common menopausal symptoms, and we're going to have a spotlight on phytoestrogens because there has been quite a lot of controversy in the last decade. So we're going to look at what the controversy is and are they safe and are they useful. Anne-Marie's going to have a look at managing some menopausal symptoms, particularly hot flushes and sweats, and she's also going to have a look at black cohosh and whether or not this is safe. Mood changes, sleep disturbance and vaginal dryness, and these are symptoms that women will often come into in the clinic and that we will help them and give advice for. We'll have a look at the role of phytoestrogens in endometrial and ovarian cancer as well. And then we've also got some key recommendations for cancer risk reduction that have come out of a report that's based on quite a few decades of research, so we'll sort of just be going over what they say. And then some specific research-based recommendations for breast cancer, and also a little bit of a look at what our role is, how we can help you and work within the medical model. So one of the big differences with the medically induced menopause, which is usually either through treatments like tamoxifen or surgeries such as removal of the ovaries, is that it's different from the natural menopause, which is due to the age-related ovarian decline. So what this means is that symptoms can be a lot more severe, and that's because of that sudden onset. So the key sort of complaints that a lot of women may have, and it may not be all of these symptoms, but certainly the hot flushes and the sweats, mood changes as well, sleep disturbance and vaginal dryness, and they're the sorts of symptoms that women will often come in to see us for help. So naturopathy, it often will help, but it may not offer complete relief. So the types of treatments that naturopaths that we'll give usually include dietary and lifestyle, as well as some specific herbal and nutritional supplements. And more so, we're seeing research behind these herbal and nutritional supplements show that they are effective and that they're also safe. So phytoestrogens are often used as part of these treatments. And as I mentioned before, over the last decade, there's been a lot of controversy over phytoestrogens and whether or not they're safe and useful for women with breast cancer or other hormonal cancers. So we'll have a look at this to start with. So basically, phytoestrogens are plant-derived compounds with estrogen-like effects. And these compounds are isoflavones, flavones, and lignans. And examples of these phytoestrogen-containing foods is legumes, especially soybean. So your tofu and your soy milk and your soy yogurt and tempeh and things like that. And the seeds, such as flax seeds. And there are also a couple of herbs. Well, there's actually a few. And they include red clover and hops. So the controversy is that because these plant compounds have estrogen-like effects, that they'll actually stimulate breast cancer cell growth in a way that estrogen does. However, the research doesn't support that phytoestrogens are like estrogen. And then there's been a lot of coverage in the media of this as well, and a lot of uncertainty for a lot of people. So why are we interested in them anyway? So it appears that the consumption of these phytoestrogens is associated with a decreased breast cancer risk. And this came out of a huge number of epidemiological studies in Japan and China and in the East, where they found that women who had high levels of these soy products in their diets had lower rates of breast cancer. So these phytoestrogens are actually structurally similar to the estrogen molecule, and it's kind of like a lock and key effect. So there's a particular, the receptors are like a particular lock, and then the estrogen molecule or compounds that are similar, structurally similar to estrogen, fit in like a key into the lock, and that's how they sort of exert their effects. Although phytoestrogens, because they have that similar structure and combined that lock, they do exert effects like estrogen, they're a lot weaker than the body's natural estrogen. So what that means is the effects are a lot less strong. And there's also, in the last decade, we've learned a lot more about different types of estrogen receptors, estrogen receptor alpha and estrogen receptor beta. And we know that estrogen receptor alpha, when estrogen binds to the estrogen receptor alpha, that there are a lot more stimulatory effects. So it does stimulate the growth of hormone-sensitive tissues. It has a lot of other effects as well, which are quite positive. It's involved in the reproductive cycle and things like that. But we know that it is that receptor that's responsible for more of the stimulatory effects. The beta receptor, on the other hand, is... it counteracts the effects of the stimulation of the alpha receptor, and it's seen as more protective to tissues. So most phytoestrogens actually have a higher binding affinity to the estrogen receptor beta, and this is why the vast majority of phytoestrogens are safe. And given that there is this higher binding to the estrogen receptor beta, most of the people who are doing research into phytoestrogens are now talking about them as phytoSERMs, much in the way that we have the tamoxifen is a SERM, so it's a selective estrogen receptor modulator. So are phytoestrogens, in that they are selective in the estrogen receptors that they modulate. there is one exception, and that's a herb hops. So what we know about hops is that, unlike all the other phytoestrogens, hops actually has more of a true estrogen-like effect. So it does actually bind to the estrogen receptor. Therefore, it's best avoided for women who have had or have estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer. So we know that there are, this particular herb is not necessarily safe.
So, excuse me, so does it include alcohol then, as in beer?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, because hops is in beer. The amount of hops that's in beer is so much less than what you would have if you were having like a therapeutic herb, hops, given it as a medicinal dose. So it's much, much smaller. So it's definitely not in the same risk category, but we'll be talking about alcohol in general and looking at the role of alcohol, so... So, like a beer every now and then is certainly nothing to worry about. No, that's fine, but just as a sort of general statement on hops, though. Okay, so I want to sort of look at two research studies. And these are the latest research studies, and they give the strongest opinion of what we know on soy and its safety and its efficacy. So in 2006, there was a meta-analysis of 18 epidemiological studies published between 1978 and 2004, looking at soy consumption and breast cancer risk. And what they found, so that's a really long period of time, a huge number of studies, and what they found is that high soy intake is associated with a modest reduction in risk of breast cancer. The risk reduction was greater for premenopausal women who consume soy than for postmenopausal women. And also they said that the diet high in phytoestrogens before puberty may be important for the anti-cancer effects later in life. What they did say, though, is that highly processed soy supplements exhibit activity not present in foods made from soybeans or soy flour. So this is your supplement, so your isoflavone supplements, highly concentrated.
Just a question, who was their target population? Were they Asian women or Caucasian women?
These were Caucasian women, but it was pulling together data from a large number of studies. So I'm not sure if there were some Asian women included in those 18 studies or not, but it was a data pool from Caucasian women.
And was it Australian or overseas?
Mostly overseas. Yeah. So highly processed soy, so this is the supplement, is not recommended for women at high risk of breast cancer or breast cancer survivors. This was what this research study said. But there was no data to suggest that consumption of soy foods in amounts consistent with an Asian diet is detrimental to breast health.
So does that mean that, you know, you can use soy sauce or whatever?
Yeah, like tofu and tempeh and, you know.
You can use that.
And
what's highly processed?
Highly processed soy is when they actually take extracts from it, so compounds from soy flour or soy beans,
yes,
like isoflavones and flavones, and they extract it out and they put it in tablets or in a powder.
Yes, so you don't take that?
No. Yeah. So that's the research to date is saying that that's not they don't have enough information to say that it's safe, and if anything they're saying, look, it's having a different action on the body, it's best to be avoided.
Yes.
Yeah. There's been a paper following up on this, just last year was published, and it found it was consistent with the previous results that the moderate consumption of soy throughout life is associated with a lower breast cancer risk. And they did say that the proposed protective effect is partly due to soy intake earlier in life. But then they also found that moderate consumption of soy does not increase the risk of breast cancer recurrence in Western women, and that there was a better prognosis in breast cancer survivors if they continued consuming soy. So this is also sort of looking at breast cancer survivors and looking at that soy does appear to have continued protective effects. So soy is the big one, and that's where most of the research has been done, but then there's also linseeds, and this is just a small, there's not been a lot of research on linseeds, it's just a small study, and it was an interesting one because what they were showing was that women were given a muffin and with 25 grams of linseed in it, which is basically a couple of dessert spoons.
So Exhibit A.
Thanks. It's a lot.
Not very much.
And it is only a small study, but what they found was they looked at women who were newly diagnosed with breast cancer, and then they took a biopsy and actually had a look at the tumour markers within the biopsy prior to surgery, and they found that it actually had a positive effect on the cancer, the markers. So, you know, I can't make any broad statements or claims from it, but it's certainly something that's positive.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by positively? What does it mean positively altered?
So it looked at sort of specific tumour markers, and it was looking at whether or not they were indicative of increased proliferation or growth or less. So it was looking at inflammatory markers.
So you're saying it decreased the growth?
It decreased, yeah. So it was.
I didn't know what positive meant, whether it meant.
Yeah, I thought. Sorry,
that should have been
a bit. I thought it might mean. Don't
eat it, you know. Yeah, no. In positive in a good way, I guess. But sorry, it should have been
right
a bit more clear there. So just as a summary, so what the research is showing is that whole food phytoestrogen, consistent with an Asian diet, is safe and beneficial. And the examples of the foods are the tofu, tempeh, soy milk and linseeds. The supplements, the concentrated isoflavones, if the safety and efficacy is unclear, and so therefore probably best avoided. And that if taking phytoestrogens to modify breast cancer risk, to use the real and the whole phytoestrogens, and also looking at, you know, if there's any risk within a family, to encourage consumption, you know, for teenage and adolescent years as well, because it does appear to confer the greatest benefits for reducing cancer risk in later life. So I'll hand over to Anne-Marie, who will have a look at hot flashes and sweats. Before that, Anne-Marie has actually made a tofu dish to try. So she'll hand this around.
This is what I call simple braised tofu. And I'll show you how to find the recipe afterwards. And I'm sorry that I don't have larger samples for you, but it's a really, really simple recipe, and it's good the day after even, which is great. Thanks, Sophie.
So as Sophie said before, hot flushes and sweats are something that brings women into places like where we work, and it's something that really does disturb the quality of lots of women's lives. So there are a number of ways we help women to manage these rather disturbing symptoms. And the first one I'd like to look at is a dietary approach. And the reason we went into so much detail about the phytoestrogen controversy is because phytoestrogens form a very important part of the treatment. So the first thing is to increase phytoestrogens in the diet. And to get a much better control over flushes, 100 grams of hard tofu and 1 tablespoon, or about that amount that I held up, of linseeds is generally required. 100 grams of tofu...
Is there a difference between linseed and flaxseed?
They're exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly the same. I think that the British call them flax seeds, and I think that the people in America might as well, and we tend to call them linseeds, although we vacillate, as you can see from the presentation. So 100 grams of tofu, hard tofu it needs to be. The blocks that you see in the supermarket are about that big. It's about 1/5 of that. And if you make something like that, it's really very easy to get. And reducing or eliminating the main triggers of flushes is very important. And this is where alcohol comes into it. Alcohol increases flush severity and the number of flushes, generally speaking, and it's particularly important to avoid alcohol if you're suffering from night sweats. Coffee and other stimulants tend to stimulate and precipitate hot flushes. Spicy foods need to be avoided, although if you really love spicy food, you can have a bit of spicy food, and the effect is generally fairly transitory, you know, while you're eating it and a bit afterwards, it's like, oh, but then it settles down. And having a poor diet that's a bit erratic and of poor quality also triggers flushes. Eating regularly and eating in a relaxed way seems to be important. Having plenty of protein, and soy is very high in protein, and predominantly a plant-based diet is very important. And restricting refined carbohydrates is also important to reducing these very troublesome symptoms. So we've just done the dietary approach. Now we're going to look at lifestyle approaches, and you'll see that there's a good deal of overlap between how we manage a lot of these symptoms, which is a good thing because it means that you don't have to do a whole lot of different things. So exercise, and I believe that Brecan has an exercise class, which is fantastic, and I encourage you all to come along. So regular exercise, particularly in the morning, because it not only improves hot flushes, but it also improves sleep. And if at all possible, high intensity aerobic and resistance exercise seems to be important. But basically, I know that if you're going through treatment, the last thing you're probably thinking of is high intensity aerobic and resistance exercise. So any exercise is good. But when you start to feel a bit better, high intensity aerobic and resistance exercise is fantastic. Tobacco is number one enemy of flushes, or actually they go very well together. So it's really important to stop smoking if you're still smoking, because otherwise hot flush management becomes very difficult. And reducing stress and anxiety is important because stress and anxiety are triggers. Getting a good work-life balance, participating in stress management on a group basis or an individual basis, things like support groups that Brecan does very well, hooking into some counselling, Tai Chi class, relaxation and meditation, all very important. And modifying clothing and bed clothes is very important. Anybody who's suffered from hot flushes becomes very good at knowing about layers. And I have one patient who calls it, I've got the onion look on. She has lots and lots of layers, and I think that that's very, very important. Things that are really easily removable, natural fibres wherever possible because they tend to breathe more, and having cotton bedding and having things on you that you can remove easily at night so you don't freeze. So instead of having a doona and a sheet, having a couple of light blankets and a sheet is much better because it's easier to take one blanket off than to take the doona off and remain comfortable. And establishing regular wake-sleep cycles. Now, I'll just explain what that actually means. The body usually has a go-to-sleep, stay-asleep, wake-up and stay-awake sort of cycle. And that gets interrupted by lots of things, including treatment and diagnoses of cancer and worry, etc. And it's important wherever possible to establish a really good wake and sleep cycle because it helps to control not only hot flushes but other things too, as you'll see. So getting up in the morning at a regular time and if at all possible doing some exercise outside, which will shut off the melatonin production, which is one of the hormones that helps to keep you asleep. And then being wakeful during the day, and then going to sleep at a regular time seems to be very helpful to hot flush management and to sleep, as it turns out. So we have a number of... we've got a three-pronged approach with hot flushes: dietary, lifestyle, and now herbs. Prescriptions for herbs have to be done on an individual basis, because usually no two women present with the same sort of flush triggers. And so one size does not fit all in terms of herbal prescriptions. So what one herbal prescription will do for one person won't necessarily work for another. And we tailor them based on the triggers of the flushes or other symptoms that are occurring concurrently with the flushes. So some flushes are associated with anxiety, others with fatigue, others with sweating, and others with not sweating during the day but sweating at night. And so each of these sorts of things are taken into account when we come up with a prescription, a herbal prescription, for a patient. So we've got a really wide range of herbs, and as I said, they're based on symptoms and triggers, and here are some of the herbs that we use for hot flush management, some of which may be familiar to you, others probably won't be. Now, you'll notice back here that the first herb is black cohosh. And black cohosh has actually come under a bit of scrutiny and therefore controversy, because it's commonly used to treat hot flushes and other menopausal symptoms. And the controversy is around the herb's effect on the liver. And I'll go into that in a moment. And what I need to say is, whilst if we were talking 10 years ago, a number of gynecological oncologists would have said, steer clear of black cohosh. Now the story is quite different, with most of the oncologists that we deal with being perfectly happy for their patients to take black cohosh because of the research that has ensued regarding black cohosh. So I'm going to look at a couple of studies into black cohosh taking and cancer. This very large retrospective study of nearly 19,000 women following a diagnosis of breast cancer, and over 1,000 of them were taking black cohosh. The age, whether or not they were using tamoxifen and other confounding factors, were taken into consideration when looking at the results. And that particular study found that 14% of the control, that is the women who weren't taking black cohosh, had a recurrence of their cancers after 2 years, and 14% of the treatment group, that is the women who were taking black cohosh, had a recurrence after 6.5 years. So it looks as if black cohosh is associated with prolonged disease-free survival, and it appears safe and may also have a chemotherapeutic effect. The other one that I'd like to look at is it's a much smaller study of only 136 women. And these were women who had had cancer and were taking tamoxifen and black cohosh concurrently for 12 months. The results of that study suggested that black cohosh significantly reduced the severity of hot flushes in premenopausal women on tamoxifen, and that no significant adverse effects of co-administration of tamoxifen and black cohosh were noted, and that so that it concluded that black cohosh appears effective in reducing the number and severity of hot flushes for women taking tamoxifen, which was a very lovely thing to find. There have been also a number of other studies, but I won't go into those. A 2003 literature review and critical evaluation of the safety of black cohosh documented a low incidence of adverse effects, and the author's conclusion was that black cohosh appears to be safe for women trying to manage menopausal symptoms, and that liver reactions, because after all it was the effect on the liver that was the concern, the reactions are very rare and appear to be an allergic reaction. And allergic reactions can happen to just about anything. Unfortunately, there are some women who can't take black cohosh, but it is a very rare thing. So there have been more than 60 cases of liver reactions worldwide. Nine of them, or it could even be more than nine, I just can't find the actual current numbers, have occurred in Australia. And I think that we have a very high number in comparison to the overall worldwide numbers, because a lot of women in Australia use black cohosh. The Therapeutic Goods Administration has said that there is sufficient evidence of the causal association between black cohosh and serious hepatitis. So what they have suggested is that a warning be put onto black cohosh packaging, saying that it may harm the liver in some individuals, and the use should be done under supervision of a healthcare professional. And that's very important. Sophie?
Can I just say something here, just with that if there are certain symptoms that someone will present with, if they start taking black cohosh, that alerts you to the fact that they might be having a reaction. So you get an indication pretty early on, you know, things like headaches, the nausea, and so it's not like all of a sudden they end up in the serious hepatitis.
Mm.
It's actually over a period of time, and you get very early signs that there is something that's not working for them. And also that you do a risk assessment with people to see whether or not they're more likely than others to sort of be at risk of having a reaction. So,
yeah. And certainly, we always say to our patients, If you have any strange reactions, please phone us, because if anybody, if we put somebody on black cohosh and they did start experiencing the headaches, nausea, etc., we would say stop it immediately, and that's a very good idea with a lot of medications, really.
Who is TGA?
The Therapeutic Goods Administration. They're an Australian, it's a government body, and they have an expert advisory group on the use of black cohosh.
And what is it, black cohosh?
Black cohosh is a herb, it's a plant, and
Is it
from a tree or a bush?
It's a bush.
Yeah.
It's a bush.
It's often the whole plant is used. Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's very effective.
Where does it
grow? Mm-hmm. Pardon?
Where does it grow?
Yeah. It grows all over the world.
Does it?
Yeah.
It's interesting. I've noticed you've got the herbs and things that can be used. You don't have primrose oil on that. Mm-hmm. Is there any reason why not?
Evening primrose oil isn't a herb, although it comes from a plant. It's the oil from a plant. And I personally don't use evening primrose oil because I think that there are other things that are more efficacious. But some women use it and love it. And if ever I have a patient who comes in to see me and says, I'm taking evening primrose oil, I say to them, I ask them what they're taking it for and if they're finding it successful, and I say, that's fantastic, keep taking it. Yeah.
Sophie, do you use evening primrose for menopausal symptoms?
No. And like Anne-Marie, I don't, but there have been women who have come in who are already taking it and say that they find it to be effective. And I've tried it out with a couple of few patients who were having quite a lot of breast soreness and tenderness premenstrually. And so I tried it on them to see if it would help. And it's a real 50-50, so 50%, you know.
I think it either works or
it does. It's
That's
one of those
a very
things.
Good observation.
The reason I ask is because I think it's, my oncologist and surgeon both sort of recommend that, because with a lot of other herbs, as you're going through now, there are side effects and things that you need to be careful with, whereas with primrose oil, there have been so many studies with it, and it's sort of completely safe. For me personally, it has worked really well, but
that's
I know
great.
That for some people, it either does or it doesn't.
That's right.
But I was just wondering why it wasn't up there.
Yes. It's largely because it's the oil rather, and we're talking more about the whole plant. Yes. Okay, so let's move to mood changes, which is another of the menopausal symptoms that can be very worrying and troublesome to women. And when I say mood changes, I'm talking about anxiety, depression, and swings. They may be related to estrogen, to low estrogen, but we think that it may be related to other hormones as well, but that estrogen is likely to play a role. And we think that probably mood disturbance is also related to hot flushes, because if you're having a lot of hot flushes and you're not sleeping well, it's really hard to be good humoured, isn't it? Very, very difficult. So in terms of managing mood change, herbs are one of the first things we look at. And St. John's wort is a very, very useful herb, but we never ever use it during chemotherapy, because St. John's wort actually clears, it induces detoxification through the liver. So any chemotherapeutic drug that is in your system will be cleared more quickly than it should be. So we would never ever use it during treatment. And then we've got lavender, withania, oats, kava. We have many, many herbs. Depending on what we consider is triggering the mood change, and on other symptoms. Stopping smoking also appears very, very high up the list, because it is something that will exacerbate mood change. Getting regular exercise is very important, and exercise, stopping smoking, having a good diet, you'll notice coming through time and time again, which is great. Regular exercise, particularly getting morning sun, if at all possible, is very important. But basically, if you can do some exercise, whenever you can do it, it's a good thing. Getting regular nourishment with lots and lots of nutrients is very important. Plenty of protein, at least 5 vegetables a day. Complex carbohydrates rather than the simple ones that, you know, I'm talking about white bread and sugar and that sort of, you know, things made with white flour, etc. here, as the simple ones. The complex ones are things like lentils and other legumes, really dense breads, whole grains, that sort of thing. So avoid the white ones and go for the complex ones, and 2 fruits a day. getting yourself into a good sleep hygiene pattern, that wake sleep cycle that we were talking about before, doing away with alcohol, coffee and other stimulants, because some people say, oh, look, I'm really surprised about that, because if I have a glass of wine, it sends me to sleep. Mm-hmm. And a lot of... I find that. I find it hard to stay awake after a glass of wine. But then what happens is a couple of hours later, I'm wide awake, and this is what the research is bearing out as well, that it actually wakes us up almost boying awake. And that's not good for mood changes, it's not good for sleep, it's not good for because it's a trigger. And having a good work-life balance and keeping up social contacts is very important to mood change. And stress management techniques, again, the support groups, Tai Chi, relaxation, counselling, etc. Now let's turn our attention to sleep disturbance. And I know that many people who have, who are currently going through chemotherapy and radiotherapy suffer from extreme fatigue. And I'm talking here more about people who are wakeful at night. And these are the symptoms for those people, and you don't necessarily have all of them, but generally speaking, women go, oh yes, that describes me in at least one of those. So establishing those good wake-sleep cycles is important. To bed before 10 o'clock, because we know that the first big wave, sleep comes in waves, and if we miss the first wave, it's a bit like riding the wave in the surf. If we miss the first wave, the second wave comes about 1.5 hours later, and it's therefore more difficult to fall asleep. So to bed before 10 o'clock and getting into a sleep position before 10 o'clock seems to be important. Trying to stay awake during the day is important. Exposure to morning light, which we talked about before, getting that regular exercise, particularly in the morning, having a warm bath or shower before bed. And I don't know if any of you have tried Epsom salts baths, if you're having a particularly wakeful time. They're really lovely. About a nice big cup of Epsom salts in a bath, and stay in it for about 20 minutes, and then pat yourself dry, and always put some oil or cream on the skin afterwards, because it is very drying, but it's very, very relaxing. It's a great thing to do. And napping as required, especially during treatment, but when you finish with treatment, napping as required, but don't make the naps too long. Because if you make the naps too long, it's likely to disturb your sleep at night. So, you know, about making sure that you don't sleep for more than half an hour, and try not to nap after 6 p.m. is generally recommended. Vaginal dryness is something that plagues women as well, when they're undergoing treatment. And the black cohosh, that herb that I was talking about before, that has a very rare complication of allergic reaction in the liver, is a very good way of treating that particular symptom. We give the herb orally, and we also, at our clinic, we make up pessaries and cream that are prepared from oils and black cohosh, as it turns out, and that tends to provide a lot of relief to women. And a lot of women come to see us about vaginal dryness because a lot of oncologists and other medicos will say absolutely no to estrogen creams, for very good reasons, of course. So the black cohosh, either orally or cream or pessary, linseeds and flax seeds, and magically that 25 grams, the amount that's in that little plastic bag, seems to be what's needed every day, ground up. And there is a pharmaceutical that is very good as well, and I've got that in brackets there, called Replens. It's a non-hormonal vaginal moisturiser that's used every third day or so, and it actually it helps the vaginal cells to produce their own moisture. So it's called Replens. Yes.
Is it ground lengthening better than actual oil?
Yes. No. It needs to be the flax seeds. Yes. Yeah. And the linseeds, ground linseeds with a bit of natural yogurt with a little bit of fruit, is a very easy way to take the two dessert spoons. Very, very easy. Now I'm going to hand back to Sophie, who's going to talk about endometrial and ovarian cancers.
This is just a brief look at before, when I was discussing phytoestrogens, we were looking at that specifically for breast cancer. So this is looking at what the research is saying on phytoestrogens and endometrial and ovarian cancers. So with endometrial cancer, and there's also there's a paucity of research, really. There's not a lot for endometrial cancer and for ovarian cancer generally. Like, most of the research available is focused on breast cancer. So with dietary phytoestrogens and endometrial cancer, the research is showing that dietary phytoestrogens is associated with a reduced risk. And then there was also a study that looked at phytoestrogens in a supplemental form. So again, this is in the isoflavones, which are extracted. And then the long-term treatment with 550 milligrams of soy tablets was associated with an increased occurrence of endometrial hyperplasia, which is not a good thing. There was no endometrial cancer reported, but that in itself, hyperplasia, so a growth of endometrial tissue, is not something that you want. So again, it's saying the same thing as breast cancer, is that the whole foods is fine and looks like it's safe and also beneficial, but the supplements, the extracts, it should be avoided. So with ovarian cancer, the research is suggesting again a protective effect on phytoestrogen intake in the diet, and that not only that, a general plant-based diet might be important in reducing the risk of all hormone-related cancers. And this is a research study that compared plant intakes within women and looked at their overall risk over a period of time. So showing, and then also specifically phytoestrogens. So in general, having more plants in the diet was shown to decrease risk, and specifically phytoestrogen intake as well. So it's the same thing with as with breast cancer. So we're going to have a look at risk reduction of cancer generally. And there was a report that is continually updated, and it's the World Cancer Research Fund together with the American Institute of Cancer Research. And periodically they'll gather all of the data. It's a massive team of people and huge number of research articles that are used to form like a set of recommendations. And it's for all cancers, so it's not specifically for breast or endometrial. And then they have a report. We've got the website there as well. And this is what's come out of it: be as lean as possible without becoming underweight. And more research is showing that overweight is associated with increased risk of all cancers. Being physically active for at least 30 minutes every day. And that's, again, coming out of all of this research on exercise and showing how important it is, daily exercise. So many
And there is, like, you know, if you're interested, there's the whole physiology of it. So looking at, well, why is this so? And it's, if you break it down, you know, they're looking at things like insulin resistance and the role that insulin plays as being inflammatory in the body. So there are very sort of detailed physiological mechanisms by which exercise is actually helping to reduce inflammation in the body and cancer risk. So limiting consumption of energy-dense foods. And really this ties back into the, you know, the first point in terms of being overweight, but also because energy-dense foods, and it's really hard if you're tired, most people go for like sugary drinks and things like that, is that you're taking the place of something that might be a little bit more nutrient-rich. Eating the food variety, and what came out of the food variety, so having, you know, a rainbow of colours of vegetables and fruits and whole grains, is that in a lot of ways it's a bit of a safety net, because by having that variety, you know, each different plant and grain provides different nutrients, so the variety is kind of ensuring that you're getting all of what you need, minerals and antioxidants and things like that. Limiting consumption of red meat and beef. Limiting this doesn't mean avoiding completely, there's nothing to say that you should, but processed meats like the salami and the ham and things like that have been shown, and this is mainly for bowel cancer, they've found that, you know, the processed meats have increased risk. So with alcohol, as a general overall guidance, they said to limit alcoholic drinks to 2 for men and 1 for women a day. Limiting consumption of salty foods and foods processed with sodium. Interestingly, you know, before we talked about the soy in Asian populations and how that was shown to decrease overall risk of breast cancer, one cancer that they do have higher amounts of is actually stomach cancer, and they think it's to do with all of the soy and the salts and things like that, and the fermented pickles that they have.
Soy sauces.
So yeah, so limiting the salty foods for stomach. And now this is what they said as well. They said don't use supplements to protect against cancer. And just to clarify this, when you actually go in and have a look, what they're meaning is that don't use them as a standalone treatment. So, you know, not using them in the place of a good diet and in place of exercise and in place of, you know, everything else that we know is important. But they're not saying that, you know, supplements in themselves are bad. It's just that don't use that to protect against. And then they also sort of said that breastfeeding is important, and that also that for cancer survivors, they should follow the same recommendations for cancer prevention. So this is both applying to the general population and for cancer survivors. And then the tobacco always cops a mention. So as a naturopath, what we'll also sort of look at is omega-3s. So from fish, and if you're vegetarian, then the linseeds and your walnuts is your best source. And linseeds, you're getting the omega-3 only if you grind them up. If you're having them whole, then usually they just pass through. It's great in terms of digestion and getting things moving, but in terms of getting the omega-3, you need to really grind them up.
Yes. Yeah,
it is. It is, because what happens when you grind up seeds is that they become exposed to air and they can oxidise, and so you're actually losing some of that, you know, that high omega-3 content. But for some people it's not, like for time restraints, or they just can't be bothered, you know, grinding seeds every day. You can actually like grind up some and put them in the freezer, like maybe make enough to last for like 5 days or something and put in the freezer, and it won't come out frozen, like it'll still be, you can still spoon it out, so you can do that. Yeah, the freezer will stop that oxidation process. Yeah.
Just a question from before.
Yeah.
How is the actual whole seed different to the oil? What does the seed have that the oil doesn't?
So with the seed, if you put linseeds in a little bit of water and leave it for a couple of minutes and put your hand in, you'll see it'll be like this really gluggy, gelatinous. And so what's happening is when you actually have them whole, it's having that effect in the body. So they swell up, they create this kind of mucilage, and they help push everything through. It's like soluble fibre. And you'll find that they'll come through whole and complete. Like your body actually can't break down those little seeds. So it has a digestive effect, which is positive. But when you actually grind them up, then you get the oil from them.
Oh, no, but you asked about actually having the oil itself.
Why is that important?
I think you said that the actual seed was better, I think, than the oil. Yeah. And I was wondering, what does the seed have that the oil is lacking besides the the fibre aspect of
There's lignans. The lignans in the actual lin seeds is the phytoestrogen. So when we were looking at phytoestrogens and the different components, isoflavones, flavones, lignans, the whole seeds contain the lignans, which is the phytoestrogen effect.
And the oil,
and the oil has the omega 3, but it doesn't have the phytoestrogen. So the five veggies and fruits a day, which we discussed before, for the antioxidants and phytochemicals, and then the increasing evidence for the brassicaceae or the cabbage family, so the broccoli, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, and that's for a specific compound, the indole-3-carbinol. And indole-3-carbinol is important in our liver detoxification of hormones, and it helps to encourage healthy liver clearance of hormones. And if you're going to have supplements and things like that, it is actually worthwhile speaking to somebody who does understand about them, rather than doing an over-the-counter approach, because you just may not be getting good quality and you may not be getting what you actually need. And I'm going to pass you back over to Anne-Marie, who will look at some more specific recommendations for breast cancer.
Thanks, Sarah. So these are the specific research-based recommendations for breast cancer risk and recurrence. And the first one I want to look at is exercise, because we've talked about exercise a number of times, but this is the actual research that it comes from. In 2009, there was a meta-analysis of the research on exercise and breast cancer, and it found that physical activity improves quality of life after breast cancer diagnosis, that women who exercised had a decreased total mortality because physical activity seemed to confer a protective effect, and that exercise both improves estrogen metabolism and insulin sensitivity, which are both implicated in breast cancer. So by exercising, you do both things. You improve the estrogen clearance out of the body and you improve insulin sensitivity. And they think that that's, that may account for the decreased cancer risk and progression associated with women who, you know, who have a better survival rate, who exercise. And of course, maintaining a healthy weight comes up time and time again. Obesity is associated with breast cancer risk in postmenopausal women, and not only breast cancer risk, but all sorts of other cancers as well. So by maintaining a reasonably lean but not underweight body is very good for all sorts of reasons. And the efforts to minimise weight gain after breast cancer diagnosis may improve survival. So maintaining that lower weight seems to be very important. Good old alcohol. There's really strong evidence that alcohol is a risk factor for breast cancer, but also for other cancers. But it's the biggest predictor of risk in breast cancer. It probably increases the amount of estrogen that our bodies produce. And in this particular Holmes research paper, they conclude that the available evidence is strong that breast cancer risk may be reduced by limiting alcohol consumption and avoiding weight gain during adult years. So that actually couples weight gain and alcohol consumption. So this is sort of a bit of a conclusion, even though I'll show you one that's his conclusion in the end. What can a naturopath do for you? A naturopath can actually help you to improve the quality of life and sense of well-being by giving you dietary and lifestyle advice and herbs and supplements. And of course, a naturopath can give you all the advice in the world, but unless you form a partnership where you do your bit and the naturopath does their bit, it won't work. And we have many women who come to see us for advice, and it's always a very wonderful relationship that develops, because if people's well-being improves, of course everything improves. Naturopaths give individual prescriptions to alleviate symptoms, and we've gone through many of, or some of those, but we could, so we've done hot flushes and sweats and mood disturbance, sleep disturbance and vaginal dryness, but we can also help with fatigue and immune system depletion and managing some of the silent symptoms that happen, like bone density problems, etc. And we can identify herb drug and herb nutrient interactions that are really important to avoid during treatment. We've talked a lot about the naturopathic approach, but there are also other natural therapies that may help. Homeopathy, aromatherapy, traditional Chinese medicine and acupuncture, kinesiology and remedial and relaxation massage all may have a part to play and can be very useful in helping to alleviate some of those menopausal symptoms. And now, as I promised you, a real conclusion. Those menopausal symptoms may or may not be relieved completely by natural therapies, and it depends largely on the sort of symptom severity, on the individual woman, and the drug regimen that they are on. And we generally have good results with hot flushes, mood changes, sleep, energy, and vaginal dryness. It's really important to make sure that whoever is prescribing the herbs for you, that they know what they're doing, because as we talked about before, there are some herbs that exert an estrogenic effect, and it's very important that not happen. And natural doesn't mean safe, it means natural. And that phytoestrogens as food seem to be safe, but avoid phytoestrogen supplements made in concentrated isoflavones. And that's just who we are, where we work, and you'll notice that we've included the website. I'm just going to connect through here.
I just want to show you the website. Yes, but it's not going anywhere. Here we go. No, I have got it now. We have our practice has a website, and we produce a newsletter every month, and this month's newsletter is on soy. And I just want to show you. Whoops. Ooh. Oh, what am I doing? So we have about 16 recipes last month on recipes that include tofu and tempeh. and I'll just show you the recipe that you've had a sample of, or some of you have had a sample of.
And these recipes are designed to try and get people who don't like soy to try and sort of tempt yeah. them into it.
This is the recipe that we just tried. And in fact, we have a sign-up sheet on the table out there. Mm-hmm. If you would like to sign up, it's free. And if you decide that you don't want to, once you've signed up, if you're not interested, you can always unsign up, unsubscribe. This is the simple braised tofu that you've just tried. And I left out the chili because I didn't want to actually precipitate anybody's flushes. so there are lots of really, really good recipes made with sort of common ingredients rather than, you know, exotic. You need to go to five different places to find the ingredients. and as I say, there's just a sign-up sheet out on the table. So I'll just leave that up.
So what happens if when you sign up, what they do is they'll send you an email saying, do you want to receive the newsletter? And then you can just access all the recipes.
That's right.
Now that's the end of our presentation.
Thank you very much. Now, if anybody has questions, we'd be very happy to try to answer them for you.
Resveratrol has a lot of in vitro research on it, and it is a component from grapes, and the only problem is that it's the actual uptake of resveratrol is quite poor, so that when they look at what's in your bloodstream after consuming resveratrol, it doesn't seem to be uptaken very well. Mm-hmm. So that all of the research is on the in vitro, and you won't find any on humans. But that doesn't mean that it's necessarily a bad thing. Like it's just that you can't sort of make any claims about resveratrol. But having lots of those, you know, grapes and berries and things like that, you're going to get yeah.
What's tempeh?
Tempeh is my favourite food. It's made with whole soybeans that are inoculated. I think it's a mould. It's a fermented product, and you buy it at the supermarket or the health food store. You can actually still see the whole soybean, and you can get it in flavoured or non-flavoured, and you can sort of treat it a bit like this. You know, you can cook it with some olive oil and some tamari and grated ginger and tofu and garlic, and it's really yummy.
And some people find it a bit easier to digest than tofu. Some people find that if they have too much tofu, they can get like a bit constipated, or you know, not everyone, but tempeh. Yeah, it's really yummy.
It's really it's delicious. And if you ever go to Indonesia, make sure that you have some tempeh, because it comes from Indonesia originally, and it's absolutely stunning. But the Australian version is pretty good too. Tempeh has a little bit more. No, it's got more protein. You need
less.
A little bit less. So I'd go for something like 80 grams, something like that, 75, 80 grams. It's really delicious, makes beautiful curries and things like that. So does tofu.
You add it to the curries, do you?
Mm. Mm. Oh, yeah, so that's the oil that you're taking.
No, it's a hard one. It's like a vitamin. It's a very hard one.
Oh yeah, I've seen them. It's a tablet. Yeah. A linseed tablet. Yeah.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, it's fine. I think you can get it from food. Like, it doesn't take too much to get the recommended dosage from food, like a couple of tablespoons. Yeah. So it might be just more cost effective to do it for food. But it's
I was taking it for health reasons. Yeah. Primrose oil.
Okay.
Or the fish oil.
Yeah. It's basically those those seeds squished up to make a tablet.
So you still get the same effect.
Yeah.
I would strenuously recommend that you give grinding up the 2 spoonfuls of linseeds, you know, grind them finely and have them with some yogurt and some stewed fruit or strawberries or whatever. They're really yummy. They're really good. How do you grind them?
You know those coffee grinders?
They're great in a coffee grinder. Really easy. It takes about 2 seconds.
I'm just interested to hear your view on turmeric and curcumin. I've done some reading and I guess those authors thought that it was quite a good
size
to sort of take frequently. What's your view on that?
Do you want to take it? Yeah, it's amazing. Turmeric is pretty phenomenal. Like, it's antioxidant, it's anti-inflammatory, and it's been shown to have a lot of chemotherapeutic effects, and there's more and more research coming out. It's a strong area of research. The thing about turmeric is it's the curcumin, which is responsible for all those beneficial effects. Again, like resveratrol, it's hard to get it into your bloodstream. Like, so it's having a great local effect in your digestive tract. But because it's a fat-soluble compound, if you're cooking with turmeric, if you want to have it in your diet, having it with fats, like cooking in olive oil or fat, and black pepper, increases the absorption from the gut into the bloodstream. So you'll be getting more of the benefits from turmeric. And certainly, taking turmeric in liquid form or in tablet form, although it's hard to say how much of it's going to get absorbed, like it looks really good, turmeric.
It's not going to hurt.
It's not going to hurt. No.
No.
Yeah.
There are some tablets that we carry them at the clinic that are an extract of turmeric, so that you don't have to take a mass of them. You take a smaller number. And I think that some of them actually have the black pepper.
Yeah, well, there's actually pharmaceutical companies that are looking into curcumin from turmeric, and they're making it with black pepper and some fat to try and... Mm. Yeah. They think that what happens is that with the black pepper, it has this like local effect on your intestinal mucosa, and it increases the gap junctions, so it allows it to pass through where it normally wouldn't. Black pepper is it's having increases the uptake of whatever it's eaten with. That's what they think.
It's an interesting one, isn't it?
It is. Cinnamon's another thing that they say is good for you.
Yeah.
But there's cinnamon, isn't it? Like, you know, I was told the one you buy in the supermarket, not the same
as the one
that you wear to foot spray to some
Probably fresher.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to Brecan Podcasts or browse existing podcasts by visiting www.brecan.org.au.